This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Si tienes ciertas afecciones crónicas como
enfermedad cardíaca,
asma,
diabetes, y tienes 19 años o más,
52,
36,
42,
puedes estar en mayor riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico acerca de vacunarte con Prevnar 20, vacuna conjugada antineumocócica 20 valente, una vacuna de Pfizer que puede ayudar a proteger contra la neumonía neumocócica con una sola dosis. Prevnar 20 está aprobada para adultos para ayudar a prevenir infecciones contra 20 cepas de la bacteria que causa la neumonía neumocócica. La aprobación continua puede depender de un estudio de apoyo. No uses Prevnar 20 si has tenido una reacción alérgica grave a la vacuna o a sus componentes. Adultos con sistemas inmunitarios debilitados pueden tener una respuesta reducida a la vacuna. El efecto secundario más reportado fue dolor en el área de la inyección. Para más efectos secundarios comunes e información completa de prescripción, llama al 1-855-213-2138 o visita Prevnar20enespañol.com. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico sobre Prevnar 20.
Voy a ponerme la vacuna Prevnar 20 porque estoy en riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica,
la cual pudiera llevarme al hospital. Así que preguntaré sobre Prevnar 20.
65 años o más, puedes estar en mayor riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico acerca de vacunarte con Prevnar 20. Vacuna conjugada antineumocócica 20 valente. Una vacuna de Pfizer que puede ayudar a proteger contra la neumonía neumocócica con una sola dosis. Prevnar 20 está aprobada para adultos para ayudar a prevenir infecciones contra 20 cepas de la bacteria que causa la neumonía neumocócica. La aprobación continua puede depender de un estudio de apoyo. No uses Prevnar 20 si has tenido una reacción alérgica grave a la vacuna o a sus componentes. Adultos con sistemas inmunitarios debilitados pueden tener una respuesta reducida a la vacuna. El efecto secundario más reportado fue dolor en el área de la inyección. Para más efectos secundarios comunes e información completa de prescripción, llama al 1-855-213-2138 o visita Prevnar20enespañol.com. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico sobre Prevnar 20.
Conan.
What up?
I get it. You want to raise your testosterone, but do any of these boosters actually work?
To tell you the truth, Disco, I don't know. I only use legacy subs, and let me tell you this. This is empirical shit. I went to get my testosterone levels done before I was using legacy subs, and it was very low, and then afterwards it did increase, so it does work.
Yeah, TestX9 works. And don't just take legacy subs' word for it. They show you how, with links to independent studies on every single one of the 9 key ingredients. No bull, no bro science, just facts. TestX9 is an NSF-certified third-party lab tested made in the USA. Level up your strength, energy, libido, and drive now with TestX9 from Legacy Sports Nutrition. If you want to really level up, go for the ultimate test deck, adding T-Assist, a pro-grade estrogen inhibitor and test enhancer, and the best-selling sleep aid, Recovery PM, the show's favorite, and see why improving your sleep is the key to unlocking your mental and physical potential. Guys, did you know that the majority of testosterone release occurs while you sleep? That's why we put this stuff together and why it really works. Stop setting for average, go to legacysubs.com and use the code K100 for 10% off your entire order. And if you subscribe to have it shipped every 30 days, you can still get the discount every single time. It's brought to you by 3-time world champion Nick Aldis and 10-time world champion Mickey James, who developed and used these products themselves. LegacySubs.com. Level up with legacy, and the code is K100.
And let me tell you, we've been doing business with Nick for a while now. This is one of our most requested items. People always buy all his supplements because they work, or if not, he would have left our show a long time ago. We use them and they work, and it's not just this testosterone. They've got stuff for your memory, for your energy, for sleeping. Go check them out at Legacy Subs. Boom.
Orgullosamente Latino hasta la muerte y después. Worldwide Latino Pride, the ambassadors of violence. LAX, K-Dog, the notorious 187 homicide.
Bang, 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 bang. Don't say nothing. Bang, 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 bang. Bang, 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 bang. Just act like
let you know that homie stop front.
Can't be stopping. I'm from Miami, not Compton. Down with the S's and the 6-4 hopping. To my Boricuas in the 787. And those up in Brooklyn pulling 211.
I come through stomping, rolling in my low top chucks. Making sure you suckers feel me every time we buzz. Shackled up like a nut, going 5150. G'd up in the feet up, creased up in some dickies.
I rap a lot, like the label out of Houston. Sneaky like the clock up in the shop, straight boosting. To all my gente down in Juarez. Karma de momento, paisa, no dispares.
Put it down from Killer Cali to the MIA. Ask the homie Crazy K, yo man, that boy don't play. It's in my NIAK, putting it down all day. Representing Southern Cali.
We were talking off the air about something that none of us even knew. You know, I live here in San Diego, so I'm always in LA for a lot of things. But we had no idea that you had lived or grown up in Compton, California.
Actually, I was born and raised in Linwood.
Right.
No, excuse me, born in Linwood at the St. Francis Hospital, and I was living in Compton when that occurred. And I stayed in Compton till I was born in the late 50s, so I stayed there for probably the first 12 years of my life. And
but what was the demographic? What was the demographic like in the 50s in Compton?
50s, I don't know. I don't 60s, know. I probably
sir.
Would say it was majority white. But
right.
Well, as I was growing up in the 60s and even the early 70s, it was predominantly black and, you know, Hispanic and a few, I guess it was the minority was white. And the reason we were there is that my mother wanted to live next to her mother, and, you know, we couldn't get her to move. So that was just something that was part of the deal. You know,
What was it like growing up as a white guy in a predominantly black and Mexican, you know, neighborhood?
Well, you know, Vader time didn't exist then, so I had to bluff it, man. The bottom line was, man, you either stood your ground and fought or you ran like hell. And I was a big fat white kid, and I couldn't run very fast. So, you know, I ran when I could, and I stood my ground when I had to. And,
right.
You know, I've got a number of ass whoopings, and I dealt out a couple too. But it was a tough way to grow up. And when I got out of, in other words, football, as a football player, I became, you know, wanted by a lot of schools, you know, 30, 40 different schools, being recruited out of high school, going into the college ranks. And when I finally got to Boulder, where I'm here now, this seemed like Disneyland. It was, no one wanted to beat you up. And when you walked out your house, you didn't have to, you know, see if the path was clear to get you a car. And,
did you by chance see the movie Straight Outta Compton?
Oh yeah, man. Yeah, I sure did.
Go ahead.
I think that was right around my time. I was probably prior to that, you know, by about, 6, 7, 8 years prior to all that happening. Because I remember Yokozuna and I were good friends. And I remember when he came to Japan the first time, dripping wet, about 380, and he was bringing all that rap because he was from that area, that Compton area, and he introduced me to an Eazy-E tape. And I said, this is what's going down in my old town. And he said, yeah. And I don't think Yoko was living in Compton, but Yoko was close by. He was an inner city kid also. So we kind of hit it off on that basis, knowing what we went through growing up. And he was pretty much still living it because he lived. I think he lived in Carson. I'm not sure.
Bro,
so
that was
all part of it.
Yeah, he was a straight G. The first time I met him, I couldn't believe all the respect he had on the street, bro. And he was real. And he also introduced me to this artist who I had never heard of at the time called Master P. He was into all that gangster rap.
Yeah, Yoko was into all of that. And he would bring, every time he came back to Japan, he would bring a tape. And we would listen to it on the bus and so on and so forth. And until the Japanese guys would tell us to turn that shit off.
Let me ask you a question. Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, you were a big guy, obviously, growing up in that neighborhood. Bro, did trouble, like, because being a big guy and growing up in, like, in a predominantly black and Hispanic neighborhood, were people constantly challenging? You know how the hell it is where, like, the big guy, everybody was always wants to try him. You know what I'm saying? Did you define a lot?
For me, growing up, it wasn't about necessarily winning the fights, because I was a bigger kid, and I would play with kids that were, you know, 13 and 14 when I was 9 or 10. So when we got into an argument playing ball or you know, basketball or whatever the game was, we would get in a fight, and, you know, everyone would square off and say, okay, you know, settle your dispute, and you would fight. And necessarily, you didn't always win respect by winning. And, you know, it's the type of fight you gave up and you put up. And so right. I think that...
Right,
that's
they wanted
where
to see what
back down.
Yeah, they wanted to see what heart you had.
Yeah, it was all about heart and you know, would you be there for them if they were getting their ass kicked and are in some trouble? You know, would you be there and would you be an effective friend or gang member? And so that whole lifestyle is, you know, I remember it. I remember it vividly, and it. You know, and I, you know, obviously I prefer where I'm living. This is like Disneyland. I remember getting off the plane and taking that ride in the Boulder. It was just a valley up against the Rocky Mountains, just beautiful. Yeah, and the college was nestled up against the Rocky Mountains, and, you know, they were offering me this and this, and, you know, a full ride to school. And, man, everybody was white and, you know, had money and were handing me money. So I said, yeah, I think I could do this. So. This is where I came. This is where I stayed, man.
So what? The first time I ever saw you, Vader, was so impressive. You were in New Japan, and, you know, you had the headpiece that, you know, shot out the smoke, and you put it in the middle of the ring, and it was so way before its time. And who were the guys that, when you got there, that maybe tried to test you a little bit in the ring from the Japanese boys just to see what you had?
Well, you know, Inoki, obviously, he tested me. Story about Inoki, man, that we were in the Sumo Palace, and I was supposed to fight Fujinami, and Fujinami just said no at the last minute, and really uncharacteristic about the Hall of Famer that we know now as Fujinami. He just said no. He didn't know what I was about.
Right.
And I think what he had said was, you know, Inoki, we need to talk about this, and Inoki didn't really ever get to him. So at the last moment, Inoki just stood up and said, man, I'm not going out in the ring, because I had been introduced and was in the ring first, and Fujinami was supposed to come out to the sold out Sumo Palace main event. And so Inoki had already fought and won and was backstage. So Inoki came out.
Right.
And Inoki had not been beat for, I think, a decade. He had not lost a fight for a decade. And if you could imagine that type of power going into the ring, and the Japanese support for that, and see, they believed in this guy. And back then, see, in Japan, things were still a shoot. The people believed that Inoki hadn't been beaten in 8 years.
Right.
And so he got in the ring and said, Masa Saito went over, you know, was yelling at Inoki, and they were like, you know, what the fuck do you want to do? And Inoki said, tell him to knock me out. And I hit him pretty good about the 2 minute mark, and we went home. So, I mean,
wow.
this was my first match in Japan, brother. And I had been working in the AWA, and I had been working in Europe for a guy named Otto Vance, and I had been a world champion for him, over 3 or 4 time world champion over in Europe. But now, man, I come to Japan the first time, and I knocked this legend out. This megastar. I mean,
right.
He was, it was beyond, you know, I don't have the words. I mean, you can take Hulk Hogan in his prime and multiply that times about 10, and that was Inoki during this 10-year run.
Imagine, Vader, he's a senator now in Japan.
Yeah, he's a member of the Japanese diet. That's what I'm talking about. This guy was, you know, so he said, you know, not only beat him, but knock him out and beat him in 2 minutes.
Talk about maybe.
Wait.
Yeah, well, it did. I mean, and you know what? That investment that night, and Inoki knew how to make somebody, and he was out to prove Fujinami wrong. He had told the story later that Fujinami was second-guessing the system, and that he said we had done our research on this guy, and he knew that I would come through and would be able to work the Japanese style for the, you know, the 20 or 30 minute matches that I would have to do.
Right.
And so anyway, man, they started rioting, man. They were coming toward the ring, and they were in the sumo palace. They sit on pillows, right?
Right.
And so they took these pillows and lit them with their lighters. See, everyone in Japan smokes, or they did back then. You know, we're talking, yeah, everyone smokes, man. So they just took their lighters out and lit these pillows on fire and were throwing them at me. And the ring was full with fire pillows. And I'm going, is this part of the tradition? Or are they so pissed off at me?
Right.
And Master said, they're pissed off at you, and we got to get the fuck out of here.
Okay. Now, let me ask you a question. Since when you went to WWE and, like, you were doing the moonsault, right?
Yeah.
And, well, you know,
actually,
which...
I did the first one in the WCW, but go ahead.
Okay, yeah, but that's where, like, people first saw you doing it. And, you know, which is obviously a smaller man move, if you will. And I remember, like, a couple months ago, there was, like, a lot of maybe controversy. And I don't know if maybe something you said was taken out of context or that's exactly how you meant it.
Well, it was taken the way I meant it to be taken. I wanted to create heat. I saw this kid on, and you know, right now and for the record forevermore, I saw Willow Spray working a match with, God, what's the other kid's name?
Ricochet.
And I went, my God, there's the future of wrestling. And you know what? You have to say that could be the history, you know, and really in hindsight now, I thought, well, that is the history, you know, that these athletic, gymnastic type athletes, you know, they're going to take over wrestling because it's so damn entertaining. And it was what I was watching was impressive to me beyond anything I had seen. Because I think from where I started out, you know, in the 80s and the stories that we told, I mean, my matches with HBK and with Mick Foley and The Undertaker and Sting and, you know, Inoki and Fujinami. I mean, the list goes on of all the great opponents I've had over the years. And, you know, I'm very fortunate to have had them. But suddenly I've seen for the first time in my wrestling career, I see something that's new and something that was catching on, and it is catching on. So I'm thinking, you know what? First thing I want to do is what, talk good about it? No, everyone's doing that. Everyone's kissing this guy's ass like he's the, you know, the heir apparent to wrestling. And so I'm gonna shoot him down and see what I can create. So I shot him down what I thought was valid critique, because what they were doing, and if you look at that match honestly, they were spot monkeys. They just do spot after spot after spot. There was no real story told, and that part of my critique was valid. But other than the fact that it wasn't any good, and I mean, that was all bullshit on me to piss everybody off, and I did. I mean, I had the whole Twitter world pissed off at me, but it was by design on my part. So eventually I contacted this kid, and we were going back and forth pretty hot and heavy at each other. I said, are you serious about all this? He said, no, I'm just following along. I said, same here, man. Why don't we get together and do some business?
Right.
And he said, let's do it. So he contacted his promoter, and, you know, $15,000 later, I went over there for a week and did up team personal appearances, and I did two or three matches and some other promotions and, you know, autograph sessions in here, because it was like anything that, any place I showed up prior to that match, you know, it just did great business. You know, him and I showed up at a little theater that held, like, I don't know, held 400 people. And this was prior, you know, 4 days prior to the match, and it sold out, and there was standing room only. And all we, you know, we did a Q&A. And, you know, of course, we shared the money on everything that arena. So, I mean, you know, I was getting the big hit. I was getting really knocked, you know, Vader's stupid, and Vader's this, he don't know wrestling.
Right.
And I know wrestling as big as anybody knows wrestling. Believe me, I've...
Right.
I
you've wrestled everywhere on top. Yeah.
Everywhere on top. I know what's good and I know what's bad. And what I saw wasn't just good, it was innovative. But in the same breath, every new innovative style has some problems. And I see one problem in that style, is it's just basically, it has no regard for a story. It's spot after spot after spot. And it is entertaining, but you never really catch your breath and go, wow, who's winning or losing here? You don't really know.
Right.
And that may be a negative. And you know what? The average fan today may say, we don't give a shit. We like it. And it's entertaining. It's like one breathtaking move after another. We don't care about the story. And, you know, if they're paying the dime at the gate and they're willing to pay it, I mean, you know, who am I to say that's not the deal going forward? But, again, you know, and so when I went over and fought this guy, he came in with this list of spots. He said, well, we're going to do this spot, and then we're going to do this spot, and we're going to do this spot. And I said, but, that's not how I work. I said, I'll try to adapt to you, but you got to adapt to me a little bit. And he did. You know, much to his credit, he did adapt to me. We had a makings of what could have been a fantastic, five-star match. But, I mean, literally, 2 hours before the match, I couldn't stand up and breathe right. I mean, I had a bad back where, if you ever had a bad back where you try to stand up and you can't, you got to bend over to get relief.
Yeah.
And that's what it was for me, man. I was breathing, couldn't breathe, standing up straight, and I couldn't, so I was laying on the locker room floor, and they said, well, I'm stretching, how's your back? And I said, it's fucked. And, well, you got to go, they had sold out the building plus 50% capacity seating and couldn't get another person in that ring. So, all in all, look what happened. Some worn-out old man, critiques some, criticized some young kid. And,
But that's the social media. That's the social media world we live in now.
If you only have a 401k, you're not getting the most for retirement.
Wait, what?
Add a Robinhood IRA on top, then they'll boost it by 3%.
You can do that?
And if you transfer in any retirement account, you get 3% on top of that.
Is there a limit to the match?
No limit. Robinhood Gold gets you the biggest contribution match of any IRA on the market. Sign up for Robinhood Gold at Robinhood.com/boost by April 30th. Subscription fees apply.
Investing involves risk. 3% match requires gold for 1 year from first match. Must keep IRA for 5 years. Match on transfers subject to additional terms and conditions. Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC.
Bro, let me tell you something too. Is that that's the wrestling fans today, like, live on the web. They're on the internet. I mean, might not be a lot of people that actually go to the shows, but every wrestling fan is still on the web. And the best thing, bro, I saw the heat that you had when you were, and like, you had legit heat, which is hard to get these days in wrestling, because in wrestling day, the fans usually cheer both the guys. But they were chanting F.U. Vader. F.U. Vader was good heat. But, bro, think about that. Like, this is like the landscape of wrestling, what's ahead. If you go on the internet and like, to like basically call a guy a bad worker to his fan base, that's like the way to get heat these days. And it's like the funniest thing is that's almost like the way to work the heat, to work
Let me tell you something. I went above and beyond that. I said I could take a high school kid, a high school gymnastics star, and teach him exactly what this kid was doing. And you know what?
That's
that
a
was
lot.
So far-fetched.
But I'm going to tell you,
far-fetched.
It's far-fetched, but it's
brother,
not that far from the truth.
It's
well,
far-fetched.
No. This kid's got real talent, and this kid is going to be someone. Maybe he'll taper down these series of high spots that he's doing and create a little story because – I made him do that. I said, no, let's sit down and talk about this, and let's put in this and put in this, and we'll still get your spots in, maybe not as many of them, but you allow me to work in there. Because with my bad back and at my age, I'm just not the spot monkey that I used to be.
And bro, you took a lot of great bumps for your size, and then you were a great worker for your size too. Not good, but great. But here's the other thing that I wanted to say. No, straight up. But here's the other thing I wanted to say is that it's when Disco says it's not so far from the truth that you could get like a gymnast and turn him into a wrestler, absolutely not. These guys are elite athletes at what they do, and they're not just doing gymnastics. They got to sell, even though they don't sell in those things, they still got to sell. They got to protect their opponent. They got to protect themselves. They got to be in shape. There's so many, bro. It's not that easy to be a wrestler. But
I'm aware of that.
I'll tell you what really what is sad to me in Disco Vader is that, they shouldn't get away from the storytelling because, every now and then, I love this.
Well,
I love to say good Ricochet, Will Ospreay, no story match, but there's nothing like a good story.
Yeah, but maybe that's where it's headed. Maybe we're going into the Spot Monkey season or decade, yeah, or era,
yeah, yeah,
and then maybe we'll go full boat into that, and then it'll phase down into, well, let's get back to the story. Let's keep the Spot Monkey stuff because it's so damn entertaining. And, you know, I'm not saying this is where it's headed. I'm saying it could be, because let's face it, what I saw that kid doing and what I've seen him do since is extremely entertaining. And, you know, if you can sell out the house with this kid doing flips and negating the story somewhat, if you sell out, the sell out. And if it's hot, it's hot. Go with it. I mean, that's what the promoter's going to do.
And you know what? And you know what, Vader? One other thing. If you look at the WWE locker room in your head from 20 years ago, 15, 10, and now it's just much smaller. You know, the big giants that used to be around are no really longer around as much. It's a smaller wrestlers, younger wrestlers with that lucha, you know, infused, you know, high flying style. So it is going in that direction.
Vader, let me ask you this.
Well, that's where Vince is going too. He's talked to this kid, and he's Vince has got this guy in. Jotted down for part of his future, I think. I mean, Heyman talked to him. Heyman flew over to England and talked to this kid about bringing him over, and the kid rightfully so, and you know, it's too soon. He's 23. He'll get ate up by, you know, the older hands there in WWE go now, but as he gets older, that'll be an obvious move for him. There's something that's very, very dear to me, and something that just happened to me. Recently, I went to a heart doctor, and, you know, he said my heart's fine, everything's okay in that area. But that I had been taking pain pills,
right,
pain medication prescribed. I'm not saying I was taking these things illegally, because I wouldn't do that. I have more respect for myself and the law than that. But I was taking, I've been taking pain pills, and I've been taking sleep, opiates and benzoids for a long, long time. And the doctor said, your heart's starting to show wear, and you're still 365 pounds, and, you know, you're closing in on 60, and Leon, you know, one of these days you're going to wake up and you're going to have a heart attack. And then from that point, you know, life becomes different. You know, after a first heart attack, you haven't had one yet, so why don't we become proactive? Start being responsible for what you put in your mouth. And, you know, I'd always depended on these pain pills and these sleeping pills to go to sleep and you know, the pain pills that, you know, and you need them after a match. You're going to... Yeah, you really do, to deal with the pain and be able to go to the gym and get ready for your next match. You need them. But, you know, so I basically got a wake-up call from this heart doctor saying, you need to get off of them. So they suggested that I go to rehab, and I went to rehab, and all the young kids in there, they knew who I was. And so I decided to be the father figure of the group. And, you know, these kids are in there for meth and cocaine and all kinds of things. And, you know, I was there for prescribed medicine, but it was the same thing. I was still addicted, and I had to say those words that I had become a person that was addicted to medication. They were addicted to another kind of medication, but in reality, it was the same thing. So I get out of rehab, and I've weaned myself over to this non-addictive, in other words, it didn't do any damage to your heart. It was much milder. It was called Subutex, and I believe it's a new generation medicine on the market. And it basically, you take one three times a day, and it controls pain, but it's not as effective. It doesn't control acute pain. And then for sleep, because I've been on sleeping meds, there's a new generations of sleep meds out, and there, you know, and I'm going to screw up these names, but Meropine and Terazoxin and Hydroxy. And so this was, in other words, when I got out of rehab, that they had put me on these meds and said, Leon, take these meds as prescribed, and you'll be able to sleep, but you're not going to be addicted. And then the next step is, you know, a year or two down the road, we'll get you off these, and we'll get you off everything. In other words, when you're retired. And so I was using these meds because a doctor told me to. Mm-hmm. And here's my whole point, guys. You have to be... Everybody, every wrestler listening to this, every young man or young woman listening to this, you have to be responsible for what you put in your mouth. So based on some doctor telling me it was okay to use these in conjunction, to use these four medications in conjunction, in other words, at the same time, that you'll be okay. Well, it wasn't okay. So this basically had a toxic buildup because they were prescribed wrong to me. In other words, the pills, the medications by themselves were fantastic. They're great. But
in the system at the same time, right?
At the same time had a toxic effect. And one of the toxic effects one of the effects of taking these meds were you would hallucinate and you would see things that wasn't there. And you would lose your equilibrium and you would fall. And so I go over to England on these meds and I wasn't myself. And in training, I hurt my back to where, and I just wasn't myself. In other words, I was just starting to be affected by these medications in England. And that was the whole Ospreay match. And yes, it was a good match and I pulled it off, but it was still wasn't Vader. It wasn't the Vader you're used to seeing. And I wasn't as snappy, and my back was hurt. And then I came back to Boston, and a good friend of mine, and you know, I'll say his name, Kevin Nash, said, you know, he called me up after that and said, Leon, do you know what you did? And I said, no, I had no memory or recollection that I had did this and I had did that. I'm going to leave out the specifics, but again, my point is, you know, we all have to be responsible for what you put in your mouth. And then I came home, and my roommate and called my son and said, "You need to get here because your dad has slipped out, and I'm still taking these meds, and I'm making the problem worse and worse." But you know, the doctor told me to do it, so it was okay. No, not true, guys. You really have to do your own research, and you have to go beyond what we've been used to. Conan, you've probably had medications that were prescribed,
right.
The you know, pain pill or whatever. But now it's with these new generation drugs, it's like they're trying to get everybody on these things and take us off of what we've known to be safe for years and years and years. And I'm not telling anyone what to do. I'm saying be responsible for your own actions and what you put in your mouth. Because what happened to me next was my son came. He flew from Dallas and you know, we're talking and we're okay. And he notices things, differences in me, and then I'm talking to the wall, and you know, I'm talking to the love seat in the wall. And Jesse wondered, well, who are you talking to? Well, so-and-so's right there. And I was having a full-on blown conversation with somebody that I had known from my past. And so Jesse just sits there in amazement because this is his father. This is, you know, Big Van Vader. This is Leon White, the college graduate, you know, and, you know, just things like this never has happened. The father that he knew that raised him, that, you know, put him into college and paid for his college education. And, you know, the father that he looked up to in so many ways was talking to a chair. And so he said, Father, I want you to go to bed. And I said, sure, I'll go to bed. And, you know, I'm kind of tired anyways. And I said, but why? And he said, well, we're going to go to the doctor's tomorrow and figure that out. And so I walk into my bedroom, and my bed had been put together wrong, and part of the frame was sticking out. And I told you earlier that you lose your equilibrium and you fall. I fell into this frame, and this corner of the frame stuck into my leg, and I nearly lost my life. I nearly bled to death right there.
Oh my
I screamed,
God.
And my son came in, and this thing was It was sticking in my leg. We couldn't get it out, and blood was pumping out. It had severed two or three arteries. It cut a ligament. It cut a tendon, which is obviously, you know, when you start cutting tendons and ligaments and, you know, your ability to use your leg ever again properly is at stake. But I nearly bled to death. You know, my son managed to call 911, and they said, you know, that your father probably won't make it. He's lost too much blood. And so they got the frame out. And at that time, Jesse was trying to stop the blood, but he couldn't. So
did you go unconscious when that happened?
Yeah, I did. And so you know, I had been in contact with the doctor, and I've told her, what happened. And, oh, you're blaming this on me? You're the one prescribed the drugs. Yeah, I'm pointing my finger dead at you and saying, you know, I've hired an attorney, and we're going to be knocking at your door soon. And that's their warning.
What are you doing for pain? Because if the first one's got you addicted and the other one's gave you hallucinations, what are you doing?
Well, I've done further research on the medicine that I went to rehab for, and there's good there, but you just can't take them together.
Okay.
You know, you can take the Subutex by itself, and it will control your pain, but you can't take the other three, and you can never take the four in conjunction, and because it just takes a very short time. And next thing you know, you're talking to walls. And you imagine doing that on a road in England? You imagine doing that on the road in Boston? I started out as a football player, guys.
Right.
And, you know, that was going to be it for me. I was going to play 20 years of professional football, 15 years of professional football, and retire. And, you know, I didn't get to do that. I played, 6 years in the NFL, and I ruptured a patellar tendon, and that was it for me. And I got into wrestling and was able to do this for a long time. So, although at one time I looked at myself as Leon White, the football player, the high school All-American, the two-time college All-American, the NFL first-round draft pick, and, you know, the number one ranked center in the country, that these things were part of my past, I now had prided myself of being Big Van Vader, the professional wrestler. And that ability to entertain, above all, was so important to me. And I would never do anything to jeopardize that. This is really my reason for coming on is, sooner or later, things I've said and done under the influence of these pills are going to get out. And I wanted to be forthcoming and say, you know, things did happen. And I was out of my control. Something I had nowhere. I was taking medications that were affecting me, and I had no idea that it was even happening. And I had no memory the next day or moments after that I had done or said anything. And
it's amazing that you would share that, man. It's very brave, and I think a lot of people are going to learn a lot from this session. Do you agree, Conan?
Yeah, the main thing I just wanted to say, Vader, is we've been in the same dressing room maybe two or three times. We never really, you know, chopped it up, but it's so interesting to hear what you've said today, because I think a lot of people after hearing this are now going to have you in a different light. And, you know, we all have speed bumps in our life. We all make mistakes, all of us. The problem is most people won't own up to them. And you're coming out here and you're saying what happened, bro. And we got nothing but respect for you, man, for that.
Thank you very much. You know what? The fact that I almost lost my life is certainly, you know, utmost on my mind. But just the fact that, you know, I blindly put these pills in my mouth and could have certainly hurt myself. But you think about the time in Boston and the time in England, you know, think about who else I could have hurt. I mean, right. Somebody that, you know, and that's what bothers me, is that somehow, you know, something I could have done or said would have caused somebody injury or, you know, harm. And that really, I'm a God-fearing man, and that really bothers me. And I'm very emotional about it, but.
Well, the good thing, Vader, is you identified it. You know, you've gotten it out of your system where everybody knows, and we appreciate your openness, your candor.
I'm talking to all the wrestlers out there right now, man. You don't want to be a cliche. You don't want to, I mean, I respect all the wrestlers that have gone before me and you know, the Rick Rudes and the Rowdy Pipers and Curt Hennings and, you know, the list goes on. I can keep talking. And that in itself is sad. But right. The one thing that told my son when I was bleeding on the floor was that I didn't want to die and become a cliche, another cliche, or another wrestler dies before his time. Right. And that was the one thing, you know, I don't drink and I go to the gym and I want to live a long, healthy life. I want to live into my, you know, my late 70s, my early 80s even. And for a big man, that's saying a lot. you know, for someone that, you know, I'm sitting here at 365 pounds. So it just, that's what scared me the most was that, you know, someone would read the fact that I had passed or hear it on TV or on the radio or something and say, oh, another one of those wrestlers died. You know, when they're going to learn. And that, you know, that wouldn't have been the case, but, you know, it's now I get another chance, and hopefully by saying this, I've given someone else another chance. And that's where I'll close, guys. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vader. Thank you very much. You know, I wanted to speak out on this incredible Vader interview. You know, pain addiction is no joke. So many great friends and performers we have lost in the wrestling and entertainment field to drug addiction, not to mention how many people we personally know who have had an addiction or been in rehab. This is no longer a football or sports or wrestling problem. It's widespread. I never took a pain pill or any other opioids until I was in my late 30s. When I wrestled in Mexico, no one took pills. When I first went into the NWA, then I'm talking about early 90s and WWE, I would actually look down on wrestlers or anybody that was addicted to them as weak-minded individuals. Until I got to WCW myself, and between a combination of pressure, anger, needing something to cope, I became what I hated, an addict. I never was in any public scandals where people were aware of it, but Somas, Percocets, Vicodin, Xanax, and anything you needed to get up, come down, extra energy, another wrestler had it or a fan could get it for you. It was prevalent. And half the office was using it too. You don't know how many times I saw wrestlers shaking in the hallways and the dress rooms and airports, passed out, having to have another person carry you to the car, driving you around because you were a mess. You know, we were wrestling in pain with undiagnosed concussions. And I applaud the ones that never fell into that trap. But I did. I never went to rehab. I should have, because I was too stubborn and proud to admit it. But I just quit. And it took a while. It was very hard because I would see how countless wrestlers would go to rehab, work the system, and get back on. So I was like, why am I going to go there? Because I'm going to do the same thing. But middle America now has a prescription pain problem, and now everyone is taking notice. Half the people with opioid addictions also have a mental illness or personality disorder. So Vader wasn't far from the truth when he was talking about this. I applaud Vader for coming out and facing his demons and asking for forgiveness. It was a very emotional interview that really touched me. And I hope you guys will visit his social media sites. On Twitter, he's on @itsVaderTime. Send him some love and let him know you appreciate all he's done. It all starts with support.
Basically, it's your first night, and here comes basically – Inoki was running the show still, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, man. He was the head guy. Yeah,
so did you think that you were going to have – maybe he's coming out there to fight you for as a shoot?
Well, yeah, you know, that with the atmosphere going and, you know, your mind is doing 1,000 different flips and thoughts a second. And, yeah, I thought, well, hey, maybe, you know, Fujinami – see, I didn't know Fujinami wasn't coming to the ring.
Right.
I thought, well, Fujinami said no, so maybe this guy's coming out and going to beat my ass. And so I yelled at Masa in the ring, what the hell is going on, Masa Saito? And he was kind of like the guy that recruited me to come to Japan in the first place. And he was that was his role in the company. He was supposed to recruit American talent, and this was a new role for him. And because primarily Inoki was getting his the bottom line was Inoki was getting his butt kicked by Baba, who had entertained and brought in American wrestlers like Stan Hansen and. DiBiase comes to mind, Harley Race comes to mind, you know, Steve Williams, Bam Bam Gordy, not Bigelow, but Gordy. And so, in other words, Baba was doing great business, where Inoki's business had slipped because they hadn't adopted the American wrestlers. And obviously, the Japanese people liked the fight between the Americans and the Japanese. So Inoki was bringing in me, which was going to be the first guy, and then we added guys, you know, behind me and around me. And obviously Bam Bam Bigelow came over and we were tag team champs. And so they built, Owen Hart was another one. So we brought over some good talent. And of course, my man, Yokozuna, our, you know, I call him Rodney, but
Japan was, Yeah, yeah, Rodney. And Japan was super hot at that time because both promotions were now hot.
Yeah, so now with Inoki taking a step to get the Americans, they were hot. And so, I mean, just each company every night was selling out. And it really wasn't a war. It was just a matter of, you know, who could sell out first.
And plus, so, there was so much great Vader. There was so much great talent because I remember you and a Bam Bam wrestling for the IWGP tags against Hase Muto.
Yeah, man. Some classic matches and classic talent and classic times. I feel fortunate to have lived in that.
Let me ask you another question because this is something I don't think we've ever been able to do in the United States. But with Inoki and Baba, you know, so competitive and, you know, they're trying to outdo each other, how were you able to put together that supercard show where you went against Stan Hansen?
Well, see, it's my memory, it was definitely Baba and Inoki, the supercard. But right. I think there were other promotions involved. It just wasn't Baba and Inoki, but obviously them being the two major players, they stole the limelight, you know. But they're
right.
They were pretty fair about bringing the crews or the companies in there that, you know, weren't doing as well, say, or wasn't getting the notoriety that they were. But so they would bring them along and help them. I think the Japanese philosophy was rather than stiff your competition, help your competition, and one day that may also help you. So a little different philosophy than what we typically saw in America, and especially with, you know, the dominance of the WWE and, you know, how he handled those situations when the company was down, and of course the Monday Night Wars and things like that. So they helped their brother, and so that was a big show. And
yeah, because that was an All Japan guy. That was an All Japan guy against a New Japan guy, right? This wasn't something we were seeing normally, right?
No, exactly. But you know what? We were one of the main events, but we weren't necessarily the only main event. You know, Stan and I was. I think there was two or three main events that night. Stan and I was one. Inoki and the Judo guy was another, and I believe Bam Bam was one with that big sumo wrestler Katao.
Yeah.
The big grand champion when right. That was huge news at the time. This guy was 6'8" and 440 pounds, and he switched over into wrestling, and that was huge for a sumo wrestler to do that. And of course, we all know that sumo wrestling is a work, like, you know, just like everything else is. And so, you know, now it makes more sense than it did then, because the sumo wrestlers were supposed to be, you know, a way of life, and you know, for any of them to do that. So that pretty much was, you know, the old school sumo wrestlers, and then this new kid coming in and getting a lot of success early, and then jumping ships over into wrestling because it was more money.
To me, it was because I was a fan back then. I mean, I was a fan. Even though I was wrestling, I was a fan of Japanese wrestling because it's way, way better. And I just remember thinking, wow, how cool is it that, you know, you got Vader from New Japan, and he's going to fight Hansen from All Japan, the two toughest guys from each promotion. And politically, they're going to work together, something that we couldn't do in the United States. I just thought it was smart. And then, of course, the fight was fucking the match was awesome.
You know what, man? We did a 30-minute draw, and we did every minute of that draw. And Stan knocked my eye out. You know what? You kind of got to hear the – I was talking to Inoki before the match, and I said, man, Hansen's not going to let me get in the ring with that mask. Because I didn't want to come down in the ring with the mask, and Inoki wanted it.
Right.
So I said, you know, Inoki, please – you know, any other thing that I would ask for, he'd give me a sure, Vader, whatever you want. But this time he said no. He said, no, I want you to get in the ring and blow that smoke off. And whatever you got to do to do it, do it.
Right.
And I think that meant if I had to kick Stan's ass to do it. And so I'm getting in the ring, and Stan got introduced first. And I think that may have been, you know, he didn't like getting introduced first and wasn't used to it, especially in Japan, because Hansen had godlike status. And, you know, I'll even go, and it wasn't just a superstar and a legend. Stan was thought of like Inoki was, you know, to have that 10-year undefeated streak. And you know, Stan was one of the baddest men on the planet, according to those Japanese fans. And so Pinocchi said, get that thing up there. So I'm walking up the steps, and Stan swings that rope over the top rope at my face, and that cowbell hits me in the nose and breaks my nose. And Stan says, well, I didn't mean to hit you. And I said, yeah, but you can't see past your hand, so why would you swing that damn cowbell at me, you know, when I'm walking up those steps? And I couldn't defend myself, because, you know, when you're walking up the steps, you're looking down at the steps to make sure you don't fall and embarrass yourself. So I'm looking down at the step, and he hits me in the face with that cowbell, and it breaks my nose. And I mean, you talk about pain. So, you know, I dropped the mask like I knew I'd have to, and got in the ring and went over and slapped the shit out of him.
Right.
And boy, we started real hot in the corner. And so I had hit him three or four times really good, and I buckled his knees a couple times in that corner. And when he was going down, he thought, you know, that I was going for an early knockout, I guess, and was just going to just screw him. And he stuck his thumb in my eye, and it popped out on my cheek. So, I mean, you talk about, you know, it's 3 minutes in the match, my nose is broken, my eye's out of my cheek, so I shove it back in, and it's like, damn, I'm getting my ass kicked.
Right.
But
Vader, did that help your career in Japan? The rough, you know, just the buzz going in, the way you guys went at it?
No, I solidified it, man, because I was over, but I'd already had the belt three or four times, and I had some real classic matches, you know, with some of the Japanese guys, Muta and Aussie and Fujinami.
Why did you end up leaving Japan to WCW?
Money, man. I mean, I had a family like everyone else. I mean, you know, I was making good bread. I was doing $15K a week, and Pinocchi was paying me, you know, he said he was paying me 30 weeks a year on that. And, you know, he said, I can't pay no more. He said, I can't justify to the television people who were the real owners and the real bosses.
Right.
Pinocchi answered to. Pinocchi ran the show, but the television company were the you know, the power and the money. He said, I can't justify any more money to them. I said, well, Pinocchi, I got to go, and I don't want to. Because we had a bond, like he thought I would stay there forever like Stan did.
Right.
And you know, he was paying me 30 weeks at that amount, but I was only working, you know, 18, 20 weeks a year. So it was a good situation, and maybe I should have stayed, kept that, and went home and worked independent. But, you know, my independent market wasn't that hot because I hadn't really done anything in America at that time. I had done some stuff in Europe. I was world champion in Europe. I was world champion in Mexico four or five times. And then
you
I
wrestled Vader. You know what? I just remembered something. You probably don't even remember this, but when you were wrestling in El Toreo, with Canek and all those guys?
Yeah, Canek and then Carlos Mayas, the promoter, yeah.
Yeah, Carlos Mayas, he actually passed away, one of the true gentlemen of this sport.
I'm sorry to hear that, bro.
Yeah, yeah. And so, anyways, I was in that promotion. What did you think about Mexico?
But I loved it. I loved it. I enjoyed it. Every time I went to Mexico, Pinocchi, you remember Neko-san?
Yeah.
He was a Mexican kid that looked Japanese. So Fujinami put him under his wing and brought him to Japan. He married a Japanese woman, and he had a Japanese baby, and really had become Japanese. But when every time I'd go there, Pinocchi said, Neko could come with me and make sure I wouldn't get screwed over. And not by Minus, but by the other wrestlers.
Right.
And so it was a beautiful time for me. And of course, when I was there, business was good. I mean, this is a true story. I mean, Andre the Giant, and I'm very proud of this. And I wouldn't say it if it wasn't true, if Miners hadn't told me, but I broke Andre's. Andre had the 1 week running record for attendance,
right?
And I beat that. And I'm proud of that.
That is true.
I got all kinds of respect for Andre, and wouldn't say it if it wasn't true. So
No. I know that for a fact to be true. And
and you know what, man? It was like, you know, margaritas and. The boys, like, we'd have a day off, and the boys said we'd come to my house, and you know, all the other wrestlers would come, and we'd drink margaritas, and we'd go out, and, you know, all the senoritas. It was, buddy, it was Mexico at its finest. I really enjoyed it down there.
Yes.
I wanted to move down there.
Yes.
I wanted to move down there, actually.
Yes. Bro, the business was on fire back then.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. What do you remember what do you remember about your time in WCW?
Well, you know, that was the deal, because I went to Inoki and I said, look, man, I'm getting offered this much money, and, you know, it's full-time, which means it's a lot more money than he was paying me, because he was limited to the 30 weeks. And,
right.
And, you know, like I said, having hindsight,
yeah,
I may have stayed with Inoki and tried to build the independent market, you know. I think Jim Ross had found me and scouted me and obviously off that match from Tokyo Dome with Stan Hansen with the whole Hawaii thing and that nature. And then we, Dusty obviously, you know, was Dusty, he was the brainchild. Like he put me in this match, and then he got me and Sting together and said, hey, you two can work. You think you two can work together? And, you know, I didn't really know who Sting was. And I said, I would sure like to. I didn't understand the magnitude of the stars. You know, Sting was, and Sting was more, you know, hesitant. Said, "Well, you know, he'd try it, but he wasn't committed to anything." And but boy, you know, after the first couple of matches and the response, you know, I've always been a heel that the one thing I tried to do was always, you know, make my opponent. And certainly with Sting, there was a whole lot to make. You know, and I consider that perhaps some of the greatest work I've ever done, or best work I've ever done. You know, in that feud with Sting. And I was thankful, you know, obviously that put me on the map of America, and you know, it really gave WCW the ability to make the next step. And, you know, and then obviously we saw what happened. Sting and I started, we blew it up, and, you know, next thing you know, Flair's back. And, and you know what, that crew at the WCW, we have to give that crew, you know, the Sid Vicious and the Rick Rude and the Sting and myself and Mick Foley and et cetera, et cetera. So that was a good crew. And then obviously everyone kept coming back, you know, with Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan and that whole crew. So, you know, I like to think that Sting and myself and that other bunch of people I just mentioned had a hand in all that, you know. And obviously, you know, where it went and where Eric Bischoff took it, you know, it just wasn't meant to be. I guess it was just part of a corporate phase out, you know, but the WCW was a hell of a company.